This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty.
So, I would like to end with a proposition to heal the divide that we're seeing.
That sound from white supremacist Richard Spencer speaking at the University of Florida in Gainesville yesterday, his speech mostly drowned out by protesters. 90.7's Emily Lang was at the university yesterday speaking to some of the folks who were there to protest. Here's Chelsea Carnes.
I wish the university had taken a stand, essentially, if that meant getting sued, if that meant putting money towards a lawsuit instead of putting money towards having, you know, hundreds of police on our campus. I'd rather take the lawsuit hit and make a stand against racism and prejudice and anti-Semitism.
What are the limits of free speech? Should the university have taken a stand and banned Richard Spencer from speaking on campus? We're at 1-866-338-5252. You can find us on Twitter as well, at WMFE Orlando. Well, joining us from Gainesville is Ramsey Touchberry. He's a reporter with WUFT. He was covering yesterday's event and the protests around it. Ramsey, thank you so much for being with us.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Let's start with the turnout. What did you see? What sort of surprised you about the event yesterday?
Yeah, so as a whole, we were somewhat surprised at how anticlimactic a lot of it seemed to be. You know, a lot of the law enforcement and community in the area had seen what happened in Charlottesville when him and his followers came there, and they were prepared. The university spent over $600,000 to protect the people here at this event, and the community showed up to protest. As you heard from that sound inside the event, he couldn't even get his speech in because students and protesters were just drowning him out with their chants. And so, you know, it was something that the community heard was coming. They responded to it. And because of that, a lot of Spencer's supporters actually didn't end up coming. In that venue, there was only the first two or three rows of his supporters, maybe around two dozen folks, and that was it. The rest was protesters.
There was security, right, though, outside of the event, and it was security that was put on or was supplied by Richard Spencer's people. They were in charge of letting people in or keeping them out. Did it seem like they were keeping some people out and letting others in when they maybe might have had to rethink that?
Yeah, so the big thing going into this was that Richard Spencer was actually given control of how the tickets were going to be given out. This is something that's very different for the Phillips Center, which is where he rented out there at UF. Normally, the tickets are handled by the Phillips Center, but they actually relinquished control over to the National Policy Institute, of which he had hired a private security firm to hand out those tickets in front of the event. And as they were coming up, they would decide whether you get a ticket, whether it was based on your race or what shirt you were wearing, or maybe they just had heard you protesting earlier, would depend on whether they give you a ticket or not. And then they would actually have local law enforcement make sure that you stepped away, you went out of the line.
Mm-hmm.
And this was something that actually Richard Spencer, just 10 minutes before in the press conference, had said he wouldn't do. He actually argued with Kerry Sanders from NBC for the first 10 minutes of the press conference, saying that he wouldn't do that. And then, sure enough, that's what happened.
You know, just given how yesterday unfolded, Ramsey Touchberry, what's your sense of the level of preparation for this event? I mean, there was a state of emergency for a start. The law enforcement presence, was it too much? Was it enough? Was it too little?
So what it seemed like was that law enforcement in the state, in the county, in the city, had seen what happened in Charlottesville, and they were not going to let the same mistake happen. So they were certainly prepared. I mean, the week leading up to it, there were hundreds of Florida Highway Patrol troopers that came into the town. In the days leading up to the event, there were packs of troopers walking around the area where he would be speaking, almost as if they were mapping out the lay of the land. They were setting up snipers on the roof. They were setting up mobile command centers with big buses. It was certainly an all-hands-on-deck type deal. And by issuing that state of emergency from Governor Rick Scott, that also allowed the Florida National Guard to be on standby if needed. So, I mean, I think considering what happened in Charlottesville, it was needed to make sure that something like that wasn't going to happen again.
Did you talk to some of the folks who were actually there to hear Richard Spencer speak?
Yeah, so we actually talked with some of them who, you know, were his followers. It seemed like, for the most part, some of them there who were following him hadn't really seen him speak before. I mean, we talked to a guy who, it was his first time seeing him. He said it was perhaps the best day of his life because he finally got to see him speak in person. But a lot of his more hardcore supporters that you saw, like in Charlottesville, who came from all over the country, didn't come to this. It was interesting. I think that a lot of his big supporters realized that the community and law enforcement was going to be, you know, too much against them in order for them to come here and voice their messages.
And then just finally, Ramsey Touchbury, what about the protesters? What was the sort of takeaway from folks you spoke to who are protesting the event?
Yeah, so a lot of them told me that they had heard his messages, of course, as many of us have, and that they knew it could be dangerous coming out there to protest, but they felt that they needed to. I mean, this is their community. Gainesville is a very tight-knit community, kind of a small town. And so, you know, they kept saying that they couldn't believe there was a white nationalist coming to their town, and that because of this, they couldn't drive on the streets they go to work every day, or they take their kids to school every day, or and they couldn't go to work out on their campus gym because it's right across from the center and it's closed. And so, you know, it was kind of personal for them because this guy is coming here and he doesn't belong. They don't support his message. And so they really came out and they just wanted to show that they weren't going to let him come without a fight.
Ramsey Touchbury, reporter with WUFT in Gainesville. He covered white supremacist Richard Spencer's appearance at the University of Florida yesterday. Thank you so much for being with us, Ramsey.
Thank you.
And if you were at the protest or you attended the event, we'd like to hear from you as well. You can send us a tweet. We're at WMFE Orlando. I want to welcome Susan Kruth, Senior Program Officer for the Foundation for Individual Rights and Education to Intersection. Now, thank you for coming back, Susan.
Thank you.
Scott Jasek, he's the editor of the website Inside Higher Ed. Scott, welcome back as well.
Thank you.
Susan, let's start with you. Last time you joined us on Intersection, you said you were worried about schools using security concerns as an excuse to prohibit the kind of speech they don't like or to keep some speakers out. And last time, of course, UF did block Richard Spencer. This time he was allowed to speak. I mean, is this a win for white supremacists?
I don't know if it's a win for white supremacists. They'll have to do the job of actually convincing people that they're right on the merits, which it sounds like they may not have done for anyone at UF. I think it's a win for free speech in that everyone at UF can now feel a little bit more secure that if they want to host their own events or speakers that might be controversial, they can feel more secure that UF is not going to get in the way of that. Mm-hmm. And so for anyone who holds controversial viewpoints, I think this is probably a little bit reassuring, or at least should be, that UF took more of the right steps in this situation.
Is there a line, though, that can be crossed? I mean, is there a difference between controversial and, say, incitement to violence or things that are beyond the pale? Or is it just a blanket, the rights of free speech should be protected no matter how abhorrent the message is?
Well, there are definitely certain categories of speech that are not protected by the First Amendment that UF can prohibit or punish, including incitement to imminent lawless action and true threats. But those categories come with very specific definitions. And when it comes to just general advocacy for – even general advocacy for violence or prejudiced language doesn't rise to that level of what UF can punish or prohibit. So I didn't watch the entire speech, although I imagine if there had been true threats, UF would have responded. But the normal sort of white supremacist arguments alone are still protected expression.
And what about the difference between the right to free speech and the right to be heard? So, for example, yesterday, Richard Spencer was essentially shouted down. There were people in the audience who were chanting, etc. I mean, that seems like an exercise of free speech too, but does the right to free speech means that that speaker then, you know, has a right not to be shouted down by protest?
Yeah, so everyone has their own right to free speech. And if someone is speaking and you don't like their ideas, you're more than welcome to sort of add your speech, add your point of view to the conversation. What shouldn't be happening is one speaker adding their voice in a way that makes it impossible for the other speaker to also talk. So if you're shouting someone down, you're interfering with someone else speaking, and also the people who want to hear that person speak can no longer hear that person speak. So that's a problem. However, the people who are either protesting outside or, you know, silently protesting, I saw pictures of people, you know, holding up fists or middle fingers or whatever, that is, you know, all part of people just contributing to a conversation. So there is a distinction there.
Scott Jasik, back in August, you talked to us about the cost of security as a reason for university administrations banning the likes of Richard Spencer. And the estimate for this event was something like $600,000, potentially more. Can public universities afford this kind of security detail?
Well, I think most of them would prefer to be spending their money on other things, but under the principles of the First Amendment, they may have no choice. Certainly, if you look at what happened in Charlottesville, the city and the university were criticized for not having adequate security arrangements in place. It's always hard to say, did they spend too much? On the other hand, this event seems to have come off without serious injury such as a death as we saw in Charlottesville. And my guess is most university administrators would try to err on the side of caution. They did a lot to keep the protesters away from counter-protesters in ways that may well have protected people. The larger question, I think, is can Richard Spencer now sort of go around and sort of force public universities to spend all this money on them? And legally, he may well have that right, but it may point to some underlying difficulties in, you know, having sound political discourse on our campuses.
Given that, I mean, I know there are applications from his group to speak at other universities. He says he's now headed to the University of Cincinnati. You know, based on what happened yesterday in Gainesville, has UF kind of set the template for how other universities might respond to Spencer's arrival on campus?
It quite likely has. I mean, the thing is, having managed to speak at Florida without violence taking place, I mean, people were deeply offended by what he said, but without physical violence taking place, it may undercut the legal argument that you can't host him without a severe risk of violence. At the same time, I would not be surprised if you see universities, public universities, look at their rules about who they will permit to rent space. Now, they can't say we're not going to let white supremacists rent space, but universities could say we're not renting space to anybody, or we're not renting space to anybody who doesn't have an affiliation with the university in some way. I would guess that we will see more content-neutral rules placed. If you don't have those rules in place to make a new policy about a white supremacist, is going to get you into legal trouble. But if you do have those rules in place, you can do more. I mean, for instance, we saw this week concern about the lease that Florida signed with Spencer gave his group control over some of the journalists' access to the auditorium. People were deeply offended by that, but apparently that's been Florida's process. Mm-hmm. And you can't change the rules at the point that you have a speaker you find to be terrible.
So what about how other universities are responding to these requests to rent spaces on campus? We mentioned University of Cincinnati. There's also Ohio State. And if you look at those two universities side by side, one denied them permission, the others allowed it.
Right. I think what we will see is, I think he says he's going to take Ohio State to court. and we'll see what happens. Mm-hmm. But I actually think there's a much more important issue broadly in that Richard Spencer isn't the typical university speaker. And right now, people are getting shouted down at a lot of campuses, and actually there's a false impression that it's only liberals shouting down conservatives, and while there have been some prominent examples of that, just in recent weeks we've seen conservatives shout down liberals at Whittier College and elsewhere. So there is a broader issue of how you promote sort of a true dialogue, and also there's a broader issue of who you have expressing this. The idea of Richard Spencer as a free speech hero offends many people because he's not actually trying to express many ideas. He's trying to insult a lot of people, taking advantage of his free speech rights. Many people would like to see campuses find ways to have controversial but thoughtful speakers, challenge students' views on a range of issues. People shouldn't equate Richard Spencer with a controversial campus speaker. There are many controversial campus speakers on all sides of every issue who aren't like him.
Mm-hmm. Got a tweet here from Palmer. He writes that universities more than other institutions should uphold free speech. UF took a principled stance here, making them an outlier. Susan Kruth, back to you. Are universities a special case? I mean, we're looking at, you know, universities because speakers like Richard Spencer are sort of doing these campus tours and it seems like picking legal fights in some cases if they're being denied permission. But is a university more than another place, a place where these rights should be enshrined?
I think so. The Supreme Court has said that they're particularly the marketplace of ideas, and they're supposed to be places where students learn how to engage with ideas they disagree with. A lot of times it's where they hear ideas that they disagree with for the first time, depending on where they grew up. That's part of really the purpose of the university, especially public universities. So I do think it is a space where we need to be especially cognizant of keeping discourse free and open, hopefully productive, definitely.
What about, though, the idea of somebody promoting ideas that are offensive to you know, a certain group of people? For example, in the case of Richard Spencer, he's talking about a white ethno state. A lot of people find that idea is threatening to them because they are not white. So do you have two rights sort of bumping up against each other here?
Well, I think it's important that the school watch out for that the school, A, not discriminate itself, and B, that people watch out for any discriminatory acts by the school. But as far as just speech, the way to deal with that is to, again, engage in that discussion, be more persuasive than the person that you disagree with. And that way, nobody's rights are being infringed on.
Scott Jasek, I want to just come back to you finally. Where do you see this debate going? Are we kind of waiting on courts to sort things out as to the parameters that public universities can put around who gets to speak on campus and when and where?
I suspect the courts will weigh in if Spencer follows through on his threat to sue Ohio State and others. But I also think there's an interesting shift potentially going on that people are talking about in terms of how to respond. Richard Spencer, in some sense, wins when he speaks, and there are lots of protests because everyone is paying attention to him, which is what he wants. I do wonder what would happen when, as some have suggested, the best response would be if no one showed up at all and everybody ignored him and he had his 8 supporters sitting in an auditorium. There are a range of ways to respond to people who say and do offensive things, and there is just a lot of people saying that beyond protests, there are other things. A Jewish group at Florida mm-hmm. had a good deed marathon yesterday.
Right.
That may ultimately be a way to counter Spencer more than any legal win.
Well, Scott Jasek, editor of the website Inside Higher Ed, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Also joined by Susan Kruth, Senior Program Officer at the Foundation for Individual Rights in Education. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you very much.
Up next, Chris Bogosh talks about how he co-wrote the movie The Florida Project. Intersection's back in a minute. This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. The Florida Project tells the story of six-year-old Mooney and her mother who live in a motel in Kissimmee just outside the theme parks. The film is garnering rave reviews for its sympathetic yet unsparing depiction of poverty. Chris Bogosh is the movie's co-writer and producer. He joins us now from LA to talk about how The Florida Project was created. Thank you so much for joining us, Chris.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. Thrilled to be here.
The film takes place in the Magic Castle Motel. Just describe what that motel is like and how you found this place.
I joke about how I was, in a way, doing location scouting for this film ever since I was a four-year-old little guy, because my parents took me to Disney World for the first time when I was four, and we stayed off the Disney property in these on this strip called US 192 that our film takes place in, and there are these many motels and a lot of their kitschy sort of landmarks, like this big giant orange souvenir gift shop called Orange World. And these things intrigued me, and we knew we had to work them into the film somehow. They've been there for a very long time, still standing.
So, you know, as a four-year-old, I'm sure you're kind of captivated by the thrill of Disney, but the more time you spend in Orlando and as an adult, you kind of realize that there's another world going on here, right? Like, when did you become aware that there were folks who actually live full-time in these motels?
You know, for many years, like I said, I went with my family on trips every few years down to Orlando from New York, New Jersey area. And when you go there, and even up and through my teen years, when I started going with my friends, you stay in the little bubble that is Disney. It's a big bubble. 43 square miles is their resort. And so you never really have to leave. When you're down there, buses take you to and from the airport and whatnot. But my mom actually relocated down to Orlando. She got sick of the cold weather in New Jersey. And around 2004, 2005, she moved down to Orlando. So I would visit her a lot. And it was then that I was, you know, I'd borrow her car when I'd go down there and just kind of explore the area, go to movies, whatnot, go to the theme parks. Driving to and from her house is when I started to sort of, this issue of the quote-unquote hidden homeless came to my attention. I remember I was at a red light, and it was beside one of the motels, and there were a bunch of children just playing in the parking lot, and they're playing a wiffle ball, hide-and-seek, and I didn't really think too much of it. You know, light turned green, kept going on home. But then, I guess once I had noticed it, every time I went back and forth on that 192 strip, I started seeing more and more, and not just at the same motel, at all the motels, and in like along the bus stops, and they didn't look like tourist kids playing, you know, they just seemed like they were living there or you know, local children. But it seemed interesting to me that despite that they were in against the backdrop of a motel, they're having the same fun that I would have, you know, maybe, you know, in my backyard, say, of playing hide and seek or manhunt. And it, you know, they were having adventures. And so that intrigued me, that they were living in these conditions, and they were in the shadow of Cinderella Castle, and yet they were making their own adventures.
How much research did you do for the movie? Like, once you realized this was the movie you guys wanted to make, how did that process come about of crafting the script and the backstory for the characters?
The email that I sent to Sean about how this we have to find a story in this situation was around 2011. And that was around the time we were doing a film called Starlet. We were in pre-production. So we always saw this film as the film that would follow that one up. But it just didn't happen that way, you know, for a variety of reasons. People not believing in the project for one reason or another. Or just budget. You know, maybe we needed a little bit bigger of a budget than we were going to be able to get at that point. And so that's what took a left turn into the road that led to Tangerine, which was a much more micro-budget project that we were able to do. But we never forgot about this idea. And so when June Pictures came aboard and showed interest, you know, that was when 2 years of heavy research was underway. And this is post-Tangerine now, like 2013, 14, leading into actually 15. And I would say over a two-year period, we would make about maybe a dozen trips down there, stay about a week to 10 days, and just immerse ourselves in the environment. And our approach is to just talk to anyone that'll talk to us, take them to lunch, and just talk about anything they want to talk about, their life in the area. And this could mean people that are living in one of the motels, perhaps, or even a lot of the managers and a lot of people working at the front desks of the places. And most of the times, people greeted us with open arms and were happy to just, you know, chat with us for a bit.
Mm-hmm. And so that's how you came up with the character of Bobby, who's played by Willem Dafoe, and he's the motel manager.
Well, we always, in our original draft, we always did have a couple of Bobby-esque characters. At one point, there were two. And then we were, when we met John Manning, who was working at this motel, that it was one of the larger ones, and it's closed now, called America's Best. And he was a portal. He was a great resource because we had this whole additional wealth of information opened up to us that would inform the script. A lot of times when you write like a professional script, let's say Sean and I were hired, you know, we're just doing the traditional three-act structure, putting note cards on the board and breaking up stories and doing it in a traditional sense. But here, it's sort of evolving over the course of 2 years, and you think you know where the story's going and you have these sequences, but then you'll hear a story from a guy like John talking about how these families are made to sort of vacate the premises for one day out of every month just to get over this loophole so they don't, quote-unquote, establish residency because you're not allowed to physically, like, legally live there. And so, you know, when you hear something like that, you know it's got to go into the script. And then you start reworking things and go like, okay, so they have to leave. Where are they going to go? And then it leads to a sleepover at our friend Jancy's house. And so the script is definitely evolving every time we take one of those research trips, which is kind of cool.
Now, you've got a mix of professional actors and folks who haven't acted before in the movie. Tell me about the process of finding some of your actors. Like, for example, Mooney, who I guess is kind of the main character in the movie, and then her mother, Hallie.
Well, Brooklyn Prince is such a miracle. Brooklyn plays Mooney, and we always had an idea of this character, and it was definitely difficult to find when we were casting kids, because we saw so many great kids from the Orlando area coming to us from a variety of ways. We had casting agencies. There was a place called Crowdshot that was helping us immensely, and then there was also just local ads and street casting. And literally, Sean would be, you know, just seeing people in the street and going up to their parents and saying, like, hey, we're holding these casting sessions. You should come. And if a child actor had one thing, they might have lacked another. Maybe they were great at, you know, at this monologue that we threw at them to do, but they couldn't really improv off the monologue, off the page. And then other kids were fantastic you know, improv, but they couldn't really be wrangled in to read anything that we wrote. And with a Sean Baker movie, you kind of need that hodgepodge of both, because kids need to learn their lines and know the script and know the story and know what their character's doing in that scene. But they also have to be able to, you know, go with the curveballs and just be able to riff. And I'll give you a great example. On the set, okay, we had a scene written with a rainbow. And it was going to be, and I'm trying to avoid spoilers here, but I think this is okay to say. There's a safari scene where Mooney takes her friend Jancy on a safari. They were going to see a rainbow and have an adventure trying to find the end of it. But then one day when we were shooting a scene at the actual motel, there was a real double rainbow. And we just sort of stopped everything we were doing, canceled that scene in that moment, and we needed to take advantage of the real rainbow just because it was this magical right over the Magic Castle. And we couldn't use it in the same scene that we had written. So we had to just come up with an impromptu moment, and the kids had to go with it. And that's not easy to find, you know, to be able to just have everybody just be able to spontaneously recalibrate like that. Mm-hmm. And so anyway, Brooklyn came in and she had it all. She's just like an old soul. She was making us laugh and just tearing it up in the room. And she actually auditioned with Christopher, who was also a local, and they were both playing off each other so great. And you also, you know, you need that. And then with Jancy, who's played by Valeria Cotto, that's an example of the street casting where Sean just happened to be in Target shopping for supplies and saw her and her mom. And I guess he felt like she had a good contrast to Brooklyn and told her mom, Eve, that she should come in and audition. And same thing, she was so great making us laugh with the improv.
Mm-hmm.
And then Haley is a newcomer, Bria Venate, and she's also someone that is just, I mean, I have to say, Sean Baker, when he knows who's right for a role, he knows. And I really admire his confidence and his gut instincts, because, you know, many people were like, oh, this person, you know, you found her on Instagram and she's funny in her little Instagram videos, but, you know, can she hold a movie? This is a big role and there's a lot riding on it. And, you know, obviously financiers, you know, they want to make their money back. They want an A-lister that can go on a talk show and promote the movie. And so it is, it's great that everybody trusted Sean, because I really think that no one else would have been able to bring Haley to life like Bria did.
Mm-hmm. Christopher Rivera, who plays the part of Scooty, I read that he grew up in motels similar to the one depicted in the movie. So there's kind of an extra layer of significance to that part.
Yeah, absolutely. He did. And that's another thing that, you know, Sean's always looking for authenticity wherever he can get it. He wouldn't have used Christopher merely for the fact that he was just, you know, to say that he has a kid who happened to be in that situation. Christopher was so funny when he came in that day, like I said, with Brooklyn, he comes in, and this is the thing, a lot of kids are very nervous, and, you know, you have to sort of take a little time to get them to not be nervous. He comes right in, and he's like, okay, hold on, everybody, I'm going to do some push-ups before we start this. Here, I got to psych myself up. And he starts doing push-ups. We're just like, okay, do what you've got to do. And then, you know, Brooklyn sees this and she's like, okay, and I'm going to do some squats. And so they're just having this like workout session, and we're just waiting for them with big smiles on our faces. Actually, after that, you know, the roles were theirs to lose, basically, because they were just making us laugh in ways that others hadn't.
That seems to come across in some of the scenes. Like, I'm thinking of the trailer where Mooney and Scooty are sitting in the lobby of this motel. They're eating an ice cream. They're just kind of, basically, they're teasing the motel owner. Was that improvised, or was that sort of written into the script the way that played?
A lot of times people think that the whole movie's improvised. And, you know, we had a 102-page screenplay here that we worked on for many, many years. But I think it's actually a compliment that, you know, the actors can make it seem so natural. But it's definitely a hybrid. And so that's the scene where we did have it very scripted. And actually, Sean has, even in the script, it's probably unprofessional of us to do this, because he'll have like lots of camera direction in the script and notes where like he wants to be, you know, because a lot of times in this movie, we're just holding on the kids. It's all from the kids' point of view whenever we can do it. And that needs to be put in the script so other people could, you know, sort of see it in their heads. So we had this whole thing scripted, but then at the end, you know, that's all Brooklyn, when she's just like, you know, because he goes, thank you. And she's like, you're not welcome. And that really makes it pop off the page in a way that we didn't have. And that's why, you know, we're so lucky to have, that's what I'm talking about. You need kids that can do that, because they can just, they can plus it. Walt Disney used to use that term, where he would call things like being plussed, being mm-hmm. enhanced.
You mentioned before that you were intending to make this movie right after you made Starlet, but it sounded like it was a bit of a tough road to sell the movie. I mean, how difficult is it to say, I'm making a movie about poverty, you know, it's at the center of the movie. Like, did studios go for that?
Yeah, you know, that's the thing. Whenever Sean and I would bring this up to people, you sort of see the wandering eyes, like, they start to tune out right away. And also, you know, Sean told me once that he actually was in a pitch meeting that he had pitching this, and someone interrupted him mid-sentence, saying like, yeah, no, what else you got? I just think that maybe it was us, maybe we weren't doing a good job pitching it as we could have, but there was a disconnect, and people were having a hard time visualizing what we were going for here. And a lot of times people just want you to give them the last thing you did. And so I could speak for myself that I would go into meetings and people would just be like, all right, let's do something just like Tangerine, except let's just call it something else. And it's just like, well, come on, we just did that. We'd like to try something different.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that was the point, even shot for Sean stylistically and just the pacing of this movie. It was definitely a 180 from the roller coaster that was Tangerine for us. This is more of a slower pace, you know.
What's the response been now that the movie's out there, and especially down here in Florida, especially for folks who know that area and know what happens beyond the gates of Disney?
Well, I mean, the response has been overwhelming, and I keep pinching myself every day because when you know, it's a dream come true just to have told this story. We never thought we'd be able to tell this story based on, you know, how no one seemed to be interested for that long of a time. And you know, it's just one of those things that you put in the idea vault and you hope that someday you get to take it out. And so the fact that it's even on the screen for me is the biggest dream come true. And then to have actually people, you know, seem to be liking this thing is just beyond anything I could even, you know, comprehend. And I still hasn't sunk in yet. So it's really great that it's been received the way it has. And the biggest compliment is when people from the area and from that life have seen this film. And we had the Miami premiere, and this gentleman came up to us after it. Oh, and actually at the New York Film Festival, it happened as well. And people were telling us that they, you know, when they were younger, they lived in the motels in that area, and it really touched them because I guess, you know, they seemed to think we had gotten something right about it. And I guess, again, that's makes me feel great that all that research that we do kind of is, you know, so important.
Well, Chris Bagosh is the co-writer and producer of The Florida Project. Thank you so much for joining us.
No, thank you so much for having me. And you know, hopefully people see this film and think about the real Mooney and the real Haley out there and start doing some searching on their own, just like I did that day.
Up next, Kaylee Honeycutt, who performs under the name Baby, has a new album out called Sunny Florida. The Boston-based singer-songwriter joins us to play some songs and talk about making music. Intersections back in a minute.
I can't tell you if I'm sorry. I can't tell myself when to get up and make coffee. Think I need some help. I can't tell you if I'm better. No,
this is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. Kaylee Honeycutt moved from Orlando up to Boston about a year ago. The singer-songwriter who performs as Baby just released an album called Sunny Florida. Honeycutt's performing in Orlando this weekend, and she stopped by our studios. Here's a track called If I'm Sorry from her new album.
I can't tell you if I'm sorry. I can't tell myself when to get up and make coffee. Think I need some help. I can't tell ya if I'm better. No, I cannot tell if anything is going right. I think I need some help. How do I tell? How do I tell if I'm well? How do I tell? How do I tell if I'm well? I won't see the side of things. I'm trying to help myself push past all the things I tell that they should never tell. I can't tell ya if I'm happy. I can't even tell if anything is going right. I think I need some help. How do I tell? How do I tell if I'm well? How do I tell? How do I tell if I'm well? I won't go back. I don't think I should. No, it's okay.
That's Kaylee Honeycutt, who performs as Baby, with a track called If I'm Sorry. It's on her debut album, Sunny Florida, and it's also featured in a Pulse benefit compilation.
They had reached out to artists to put out unreleased music, so that song that I just played, If I'm Sorry, got put out a year before the record got put out. And it was really important to me because I lived a couple streets down. I'm an artist in the community, and I think in the DIY community, we're kind of hand in hand with the LGBT community. We're hanging out in the same spaces, and we are interchangeable and the same people. And so, I was really happy that we all banded together and tried to do a couple things, whatever we could to raise some money. So we did that. I put my song on the benefit CD, and Ugly Orange, our first show actually was a benefit show for Pulse, and we raised a couple $100, which was really cool.
Mm-hmm. So that song means quite a lot to you.
Yeah, it's probably my favorite song I've ever written.
So tell me about Sunny Florida.
Well, Sunny Florida, I recorded here. It's my debut album. I recorded it with my friend Riley Corcoran, who plays in the band Death Trimmers. And yeah, it was a lot of fun recording it. I was kind of just exploring my songwriting and trying to kind of solidify it. So I decided to try and put the record together. And yeah, it's really good. And it has a lot of my feelings about Florida. So that's why it's called Sunny Florida.
Mm-hmm. There's something more to the title than it's not just all about the sunshine and the good times, though, right?
No, Sunny Florida is kind of like a sarcastic, like, kind of thing, you know, because when you're from Florida, you don't live in the touristy part that everyone knows, where it's like, come visit beautiful sunny Orlando, Florida. You know, like, you live on East Colonial, you live on 50, it's like, you live by, like, old rundown shops. Yeah, it's not what everyone thinks it is.
So tell me about the name Baby. Where does that title come from?
I'm the youngest in my family. I got four older brothers, and I cried a lot growing up. It was very emotional, and they like to pick on me, and I turned to songwriting to kind of express myself, and so it seems fitting.
So when did you first start writing music?
Well, I mean, I used to make up songs and sing them to my mom since I was a little kid, but I started writing with an instrument in ninth grade.
And so you also perform in a band, right?
Yeah. So I moved up to Boston last year after I signed to Yellow K Records and put a live band together. I wanted to kind of be afforded the opportunity to tour and literally be able to afford it. I couldn't find a good job down here, and I landed a good job in Boston, and the music scene up there is mm-hmm. awesome. So yeah, I put a live band together up there, and they're really great.
Before you moved to Boston, did you kind of have an idea of what that music scene was going to be like, or was it a revelation to get there and just figure out what was going on?
Well, no, I was applying for jobs in Boston and New York, and I was kind of looking at certain places on purpose, and I knew a music writer in Boston, and I had heard a couple of bands that were, like, really wild, like there's this band called Birthing Hips, and they're so good. A couple of them go to New England Conservatory for Music, a couple of them, I don't know if one of them went to Berkeley, and then one of them is just, like, self-taught, but they have a really wild sound, and so there's, like, a lot of cool bands there that I was hearing that were really unique, and so I was just kind of excited to get in the scene.
Do you feel like your music has changed since you got up there and been exposed to different sounds?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I'm excited. I'm starting to demo out songs for the next record. I'd probably be a little less surfy. Still kind of same core songwriting, you know, it's mm-hmm. still me, but just different vibe, I guess.
Now, the surfy element, as you say, is that because you grew up in Florida, or is it just what you were listening to as you developed your sound, your voice?
I think both. I mean, I listened to a lot of different artists. I went through a lot of different phases when I was learning how to play guitar and do songwriting, and I was into, like, you know, bluegrass and Americana, and then, like, rock, and then pop, and I was in, like, a synth pop band, and I did a lot of different things. I mean, at the time, I was listening to current indie rockers like Mitski, Frankie Cosmos, and just like the younger female songwriters who are on the come up, and was very influenced by them.
What's the audience like up in the Boston area for the kind of music you play?
Well, I mean, there's like 30 colleges within like such a small radius, so it's definitely a college town. It's really young people. It's really cool because there's two really good music schools there, but then there's also, you have people from MIT who are doing like noise projects, and they know how to like build their own pedals and like build these contraptions with like wires. And then they meet up with the Berkeley students who are like amazing at guitar. And you just kind of get a lot of really unique sounds because you have everyone in my band is from a different place. Like Boston is all transplants, college kids. Like my bass is from LA, my guitarist is from South Korea, my drummer lives in Connecticut, and I'm from Orlando. So it's like all the bands are so cool up there because everybody's bringing in different influences.
What about Orlando?
I love Orlando, and the music scene's really small because Orlando, I think, is just a smaller city. We're growing, but yeah, I was booking here under Ugly Orange, which is still currently like happening. That's Hannah and Nicole, and they're super awesome. They booked a really cool show last night that sold out, which is Mild High Club. They've been getting like kind of some growth and gotten a cool bands to come through that probably wouldn't have come through. So they're, you know, I think people work really hard to try to make Orlando a special place, and it is in a lot of ways.
And you've got a show coming up.
Yeah, it's going to be this Sunday at Uncle Lou's Entertainment Hall. It's right down the street from Will's Pub, and Zoya Zafar is playing. She's a really great songwriter. Julie Bruce from TV Dinner is going to be playing, and then I'm going to be playing some songs solo, and I'm actually going to have my friend Nicole play drums on some of the songs too.
Well, Kaylee Honeycutt performs as Baby. You can hear her this Sunday. Thank you so much for coming in and performing for us.
Thanks for having me.
And to take us out, a track called Home Sweet Home.
I built a home in my head. All of the people are made out of clay. I built a chair with two legs. That was all that it took to hold me. Me, 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 me.
That's Kaylee Honeycutt, who performs as Baby, with a track called Home Sweet Home. Support for Intersection comes from Florida Hospital and from our listeners. Intersection's producer is Brendan Byrne. The executive producer is Catherine Welch. Our intern is Alana Campbell. Technical direction from Nicole Darden-Creston. You can find previous episodes of Intersection on our website, wmfe.org. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. And find us on the NPR One app. I'm Matthew Petty. Thanks for listening.